Jack Kopke has retired, we're sorry to say, so we'll have a rotating set of hosts for this program for a while. Today, the Coastal Desk brings you to an island in South Louisiana. I've been reporting from there on and off over the past 6 months for a project we did with NPR. And we've been looking at how sea level rise and land loss is impacting coastal communities. It's happening all over the world, and people and policymakers are trying to figure out what to do. Our story is about one of the first communities in America to be lost partly due to sea level rise, the tiny island of Île de Jean-Charles. It's sunset on the island. A dozen or so men gather in the dusk on little wooden fishing platforms jutting into a channel that leads to the Gulf. 67-year-old Edison Dardar stands in his tall white rubber boots, casting a weighted shrimping net into the murky water. He rhythmically tosses it out and pulls it back again.
And is this something you do every night?
Every night we do that.
That's how we do it. Catch them like that. Then you swing. Watch your mind.
He can usually catch 10 or 20 pounds a night.
We throw in the cast net, we catch some shrimp, and we like to do that.
Come out here with your net and throw it in the shallow water?
Yeah, it's not deep. It's about 2 foot, 3 foot of water.
And pull it in, and then?
Then you got some shrimp in the cast net.
Dump it in the bucket.
Dump it in the basket.
And how's it looking in the basket now?
No. You only got about a dozen.
It seems like a timeless scene, a Native American living off the land, or in this case, the water. But 20 or 50 years ago, you could never catch shrimp by just standing on the shore of the island. 100 years ago, Île de Jean-Charles was in the middle of a freshwater marsh. And these shrimp are ocean creatures. It's just one example of how dramatically the ecosystem has changed along the Gulf. Louisiana's coast was built by the mouth of the Mississippi River, and it looks a lot different from other coasts. It's made up of these marshy fingers that reach out to the sea. But those marshes have eroded, and the ocean is slowly but surely taking over. And as that salt water comes into the marshes, it's making them brackish rather than fresh. Île de Jean-Charles is right on that line. 50 years ago, when the island was surrounded by fresh water, Dardar hunted for alligator and oysters. Back then, the island was 11 miles long, and hundreds of families lived there. Now, it's just 2 miles long, and there are only about 60 people left. Diehards, like Dardar.
I'm a fisherman, and I live all my life here. That's all I ever done, fishing. I don't know nothing about other work or nothing like that, just fishing. So that's all I ever done, but fishing. And that's all I'm going to do.
The island is one of the first communities along the Gulf Coast that will be taken over by the sea, probably within 2 decades. And there's 3 main reasons why. Hurricanes. With less marsh to protect it, each storm washes away more of the land. Dredging. Oil and gas companies have carved canals through the delicate marshes so boats can reach offshore rigs. And climate change. Sea level rise is swallowing what's left of the island.
We all know that eventually this area is going to be taken over by the salt water, and so eventually this is going to disappear.
Albert Nakyan is the chief of the Native American tribe that lives on the island. The Biloxi Chitimacha Choctaw moved here in the 1800s from all over the South to escape discrimination on the mainland. That was after the Federal Indian Removal Act. Chief Nakyan says it's not just the island that's washing away. It's the tribe itself. Without a place to call home, the tribe has started to scatter and assimilate. And after every hurricane, more people move away. Most of the tribe has already moved to higher ground. Even Nakyan has left, after he and his young family barely survived a hurricane back in the 70s.
We took like 11 inches of water in my house. We lost all of our new appliances and new furniture and all that. I said, oh no. And then plus, we had to drive back and forth on the road, which had water on it. Quite a few times during the year, and you know, you're looking at a foot or so of water almost coming into your car. I said, no, I said, we gotta go.
He moved to nearby Point of Shen, where he lives with his wife and elderly father-in-law. He used to sell natural gas. He has a big garage with a motorcycle and a truck.
If I would have stayed here, I probably wouldn't have what I have today, because I mean, every 2 or 3 years you have to purchase a new appliance and new furniture and all that.
this crisis is dividing the tribe between the members on the island and those who have left. It's not a simple choice for anyone. Nakan resents having to choose between culture and prosperity.
Unless maybe you're Indian and you'll never understand. But, you know, we're attached to this land. Like the fishermen would say, it's in our blood. You know, this is in our blood.
But the way Nakan sees it, the tribe has to adapt to survive. Like it or not, everyone will eventually have to move off the island, and the tribe's culture will disappear along with them. This January, the federal government gave the tribe $48 million to relocate. That's almost $2 million per family. Nakian wants to do more than just save the individuals on the verge of losing their homes. He wants to use the money to reunite the tribe and save the culture for generations. The plan will set a precedent. It's the first community to be forced to move, but it won't be the last. Nakian has an elaborate plan to save the culture. The question is whether it's practical. He drives down to the end of the island, to an empty lot. There's a skeleton of a dead oak tree. It's overgrown with grass, and the water laps at the shore nearby. He reminisces about when he was a kid, in the 40s and 50s. And the island then was full of life.
You know, we had a little garage here. We had the house. We had a chicken coop. We had a corral out there for the cows. Right there at the corner, we had a little garden.
And what was it like here back then?
Back then? It was great. It was wonderful. It was better wonderful. It was heaven. It really was. It was really, really great. You know, because we had everything we wanted. We had the water. We could fish. We could play around. We could go hunting. We could just go to the garden and get us a cucumber or a cantaloupe or whatever we had that we could eat.
He says though they were poor, they were happy, and the island was bountiful. He wants that back more than anything. So when he learned that the tribe could get millions of dollars to relocate, he immediately started putting together a monumental plan to recreate that experience for future generations. The tribal council worked together with planners and academics to design a new community that would meet the needs of everyone on the island and appeal to those who have moved away. Built 30 miles inland in the sugarcane flatlands, it would be modeled after their current home. The houses would be built in a half circle in the shape of a palm leaf, a sacred symbol.
We'd be starting our culture all over again, teaching our kids, because right now they're scattered around, so they have no idea where our culture was before.
There would be a community center, a health clinic, and an open powwow field, and trails that wind around man-made bayous. So it looks almost like the island. Nakan pulls a big map out of his garage and sets it on a stand.
But see, we'd have trees all around, so we'd be still in the trees where nobody could see us. And the entryway would be blocked off by these buildings, so the community back here would be all private, and this would be our hangout place right here. And then plus we've got a ball field, we've got a community garden.
They'll even stock the water with crawfish so they can harvest them. They plan to bring plants from the island to complete the picture. And perhaps most importantly, there are houses for 150 families, not just the 27 families on the island. Nakan wants to bring the tribe back together in a big way. Little colorful pins dot his map.
What are the pins that we're looking at?
The pins are where we put all the houses at.
But they have names on them already.
Yep, they have names on them already. People put their names. So we have that. And all the white ones are those from the island. So we try to put
Nakan's
them all together.
Basically hoping he can get the entire tribe to migrate again, like they did in the 19th century. He has to convince the tribal members who've moved away over the years to uproot all over again and join him. And he has to convince the ones on the island to move before the next big storm. I asked shrimper Edison Dardar about that plan.
I think it's crazy, definitely. For me, I think it's crazy, yeah.
To Dardar, moving 30 miles north would be like moving to Mars.
Over here, you can go walk, ride the bike, run if you want to run, pull some grass, climb the tree. You can do everything here. If I move way over there, what I'm going to do, stay in the house all day long, just wait and get old and die? That's about the only thing.
If we don't move now, we won't have another chance.
Nakan has his work cut out for him. On top of all that, the state is balking at the scope of his plan. The tribe got $48 million from the federal grant, and this plan will cost $100 million. The rest would have to come from donations. But the state's actually in charge of how the money is spent, and it has to approve any plan. and they're reluctant to create an incredibly expensive precedent for just 27 families, knowing they'll eventually have to move thousands more. Shirley Laska is a retired sociology professor from the University of New Orleans who helped Nakan design the plan.
The reinvigoration of the culture is key to this concept. You have a tribe that has historically been an amazing group of people. They took a left turn with the Trail of Tears. They came into an unknown area. They established themselves. They flourished until the environment put risks to them that they couldn't deal with, and their culture of community dynamics and language and willingness to struggle to achieve goals is just remarkable, and it will be lost if only a small number of them are rejoined.
Laska and the tribe are frustrated. Officials from the state say the plan is too expensive and elaborate. They're hiring a firm to draft a new one, a plan that'll include only enough homes for the people who currently live on the island, 27. The chief has spent months working to save his plan, even flying to D.C. to lobby the federal government to intervene.
The chief has made it sound like it's this plan or nothing.
That's what I hear. That's the strength of his conviction. And this is a draining, draining experience. It is unbelievably draining. Just imagine how we could go forward if all the energy we're using on trying to make sure that it happens could be used toward having it happen. It's stunning in terms of the energy that's been taken.
Nakan is in talks with the state to negotiate a plan, but at this point, it's all up in the air. And he wants to move his people soon, before the next big hurricane washes more homes away. He's worried, uncertain, and that comes through in his actions. Standing on the wooded lot where his first house stood when he was a young married man, he points to some bright green young saplings.
Why'd you plant all these trees here?
To try to put some bow trees back in here to protect from the wind, you know, so that we can...
Yeah, but it's a washing away.
It is, but nevertheless we tried. We got them for free, so all it was labor.
So you're still planting trees here, even as you try to get people to move off the island?
Yes.
So do you think that sends them mixed messages?
Well, it could. But the thing is, if it never happens, you know, if we just wait and see, then don't do nothing, well, then we're just as much to blame. So if this doesn't happen, well, at least we have trees for maybe to make it last a little bit longer.
He's planting saplings on the island, trees whose roots could help prevent the land from washing away, even as he tries to convince his people to move away. He won't settle for a trailer park or cookie-cutter subdivision for a few members of the tribe. To him, the only way to keep his tribe whole is to bring them back together in a place where they can thrive, or just let the island and the tribe with it wash away. I'm Tegan Wendland, and you're listening to a special edition of All Things New Orleans here on 89.9 WWNO.
I'm Ryan Kailoff. I'm the other half of the Coastal Desk here at WWNO, and I was covering Tegan while she was out at Ile de Jean Charles. So, Tegan, tell me, you actually spent the night there, right?
Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time down on the island for this project over the past 6 months or so. And earlier this summer, I went and camped out at an elderly couple's house, like in their backyard. The distant relatives of the chief, pretty much everyone is related there. And that was a really interesting experience, staying overnight on the island itself, because I realized, like, life just sort of goes on there. You know, it seems like it's this place in this huge crisis, but when you actually spend time there, you see, like, the school bus comes, there's a fire station, people go to work and they come back at night, they gather at the end of the island at night to go shrimping together. And it was a really beautiful place. It got really quiet and really dark at night, and then the frogs started. And I didn't sleep very well. It was very, very hot. And there were more mosquitoes there than I've ever experienced anywhere in my life. But those things aside, I could see why people sort of are hanging on to it and why they view it as this special place that they don't want to leave.
Do you think you're the only reporter who's spent the night there?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think it was good for my relationship with the folks there, too, because, you know, I brought them a big thing of peaches that I picked up on the way and, like, sort of had breakfast with them and dinner with them. And I think that they saw that I was, like, more serious about telling the story than maybe someone who just sort of parachuted in for the afternoon to, like, get the photos of the kids playing on the street and, like, get the interview of the guy who doesn't want to leave and then just left. So I think it was great to stay there, even if it was an uncomfortable night's sleep. And I got a lot of shrimp. I bought a bunch of shrimp and brought them back here and then had to peel them all in my backyard.
I ate some of those shrimp.
They were good. They were the best. Probably the freshest shrimp I've ever had. Caught by Edison Dardar himself.
So as we've learned since you did a lot of this initial reporting, the tribe is facing a lot of problems getting this plan implemented. And this was supposed to be the model for how other communities around the country that need to relocate do their thing. What do all these problems say?
Yeah, so that's really how the state and the tribe sold this plan to HUD, which is the agency that gave this $48 million grant to Ile-de-Jean Charles. The state will manage that money. But they really sold it as this pilot project for, you know, how we might move coastal communities in the future. And the fact that such a small community with just, you know, 27 families, a very cohesive tribe, you could argue, is having such a hard time navigating this move, I think doesn't bode very well for how the state might sort of plan and execute these relocations in the future. It's still sort of unfolding, but the negotiations between the state and the tribe are ongoing, so it's still unclear as to where they're going to move and when.
And it was a contest, right? I mean, the fact that Louisiana got this money means that somebody else didn't. What do you know about that?
Right. So other communities across the country, both states and cities, got funding for similar projects, like retrofitting homes and improving drainage in Connecticut or improving watershed management in Ohio. But some communities that applied for this HUD grant didn't get any money ultimately, like an Alaskan Native village. And so those communities are still faced with the challenge of coming up with the funds they need to, you know, make these necessary relocations in the future. And some people worry that this system of, you know, having this sort of grant application process for federal money pits these communities against each other and that it's not ultimately very productive. It's sort of like a short-term fix, but we need a longer-term solution.
Thanks, Tegan.
And thanks for joining me on All Things New Orleans today, Ryan.